You're listening to 91.5 FM, WMFO, Tufts Free Form, commercial free, community based radio. That's 91.5 FM on your dial if you're in this area. Medford, Somerville, parts of Boston, parts of the suburbs, it varies. But also you can go to WMFO.org, WMFO.org, and there you can listen live, you can listen to the archived shows, and there's a lot of, we call it freeform radio also. Also Tufts Educational Radio, because it emanates from Tufts University. But let's talk about that freeform thing for a minute. Freeform means that the station doesn't say to everybody, you must play a certain thing. Like, this is not the blues station, it's not the pop station, it's not the, you know, classical station. It is freeform. It is, you know, whatever the DJs who are able to get a show together and get approved and so on, what they want to put forward for their theme, or maybe lack of theme. Maybe they just get in and you know, talk or whatever. So there's talk shows, there's music shows, there's talk and music combined. There's it's freeform. And I like that. That's cool. And there's a lot of good stuff you can find on WMFO.org if you want to check out the programming. Or just listen, keep your radio on if you live close enough to 91.5 FM. If you live close enough to Tufts University. And Tufts is up on a hill here, and border again of Somerville and Medford. And I've heard the station in some strange places. I've heard it out in the western or northwestern burbs. I've heard it suburbs of Boston. We got a call in, a couple calls in from downtown Boston. So I don't know. It just maybe, I don't know enough about radio frequencies, but maybe they're affected by the wind somewhat or whatever. So sometimes we're getting calls in from far away. Sometimes it's just people down the street. But because it is live radio and not just a podcast, we are reaching a lot of people. That's really great. We have the potential to reach a lot of people. Spread the word. We're on Facebook, Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. So as I mentioned earlier in the show, one of those things we're supposed to put are you know, I mean, if you sliced up my check in all the ways it had to be sliced up, it would be confetti. So it would be, I mean, it would be nothing, it would be confetti. It would be, you couldn't use it for anything. You couldn't read the numbers. You couldn't, so my confetti, part of my confettied check is supposed to go to saving for family vacations. I mean, people need leisure time. There's this famous sociologist or whatever he was named Maslow, M-A-S-L-O-W, and there was this thing that he developed, supposedly, it's never usually just one person, but Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and it starts off, of human needs, you know, it starts off pretty straightforward. You need food, shelter, clothing, and then, I forget what, there's a couple others, or maybe just one other, and then it says leisure time. Wow, where'd that come from? Well, it turns out, yeah, I mean, people have to sleep, right? And they also need to have some time to chill, some leisure time, and you know, a lot of leisure time for working people is not really leisure time. I mean, we're cleaning our houses, our apartments, we're mowing the lawn if we have a lawn, we're, you know, fixing the car if we can figure out how to fix these cars now with all the computer stuff in them, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, you're doing a lot of stuff on your own, and you don't have leisure time. I mean, that's not leisure time. So, but people need that. People need to rest and think. And as socialists, we're for anything that improves the living standards of working people, of the working class. And that means, that includes people that don't work anymore. Like if you're retired, say you're 60, 70 years old and you can't find a job. Yeah, well, that's understandable because the capitalists don't want to give jobs to people they feel they can't exploit as easily or as easily physically or mentally as a lot of elderly people. Now, in the United States, you also have this phenomenon now of people skip, they're not doing retirement, they're working till they die. A lot of people working basically till they keel over because the retirement pension plans are pretty much on the way out, or a lot of them are gone. I heard a figure, I'd like to double check this, but we're down to 7% defined benefit pensions. Those are the pensions where you get a pension from the company as part of working there. That's part of your benefit package. Not an IRA or something that you're putting money into, but actually funded by the corporation pension. That's called a defined benefit pension usually. There are other types, but the general idea is that you don't have to put money into it to retire on a decent pension. Operative word, decent, even there, but you don't even have any of that in a lot of among a lot of workplaces now, and people are a retirement fund is now something that maybe the corporation puts a little bit into, then you have to put the rest, or you have to put all of it into. And they make it very interesting sounding and complicated, and you can do this IRA, this type, or this type, individual retirement account, and you know, but they don't tell you that it's also tied to the stock market, so you lose money on it a lot, or they don't tell you that, hey, you're getting paid so little, you're not going to be able to afford to put much into your individual retirement account, et cetera. So a lot of people here are working till they die, but the you know, the original point was there's so many things you have to save money for that you end up not being able to save money, right? You're using all your money for immediate needs. And I just got a electric bill for $291. Now, that's based on running two small window air conditioners, not all the time, during the recent, you know, really hot weather we had in the month of July. This is absurd. This is insane. There should be a campaign against this because electricity is regulated in the United States, however, weekly. There is still some regulation. The regulations are a lot weaker now, and that's shown by how high the bills are. You know, I mean, there should not be any private utility or energy companies. They should be completely run by the government and then have democratically elected boards of directors. Or however, whatever, you don't have to have a board of directors. You could have some other ways of organizing that, but it would be elected by people in regions and states and areas, including the top coordinators of the energy company, of the energy, it wouldn't all be a company, but energy production facility or facilities or whatever you want to call it, or consortium of facilities. And that's it should be public domain. It should be in the public. You know, the public should run it. It's not happening. There's a couple big companies that run the show for the most part in different states, and we're getting screwed. We're getting hurt really bad by this money. This is money that I'm not going to be able to save for college education for my kids. This money I'm not going to be able to save for elder care, retirement. Money I'm not going to be able to save for. We're not going to be able to save for the next thing. The old family vacation. Whatever happened to that? Well, if you're like me, as we said opening the show. No such thing. You know, I'm getting to the point where my kids are getting older. One is 14 and one is 9, about to turn 9. One is about to turn 14, one is about to turn 9. They're both, but, you know, and I mean, when I say about to, I mean within the next couple months. So, I think back on my growing up in a larger family, four kids, with probably not as much money coming in. I'm not going to qualify that. Definitely not as much money. No, we were poorer than we are now, on paper at least, nominally. Although we'd have to pay. So that's the thing. Back in the post-war upswing, the 60s and 70s, a lot of families didn't have to pay as much stuff out. More stuff was free. More stuff was a social benefit or regulated, like electricity. I know my parents didn't pay that much electricity, even with until they got older. But, you know, the 60s, 70s, into the 80s, there was, you know, even with air conditioning, you didn't pay as much. You didn't pay as much for water. You didn't pay nothing for water back then, hardly at all. Just really absurd amount of things that we have to pay for. I have a huge water bill, 200-something water bill. Never use the water. We don't water our lawn. We don't use the water normally. Just, you know, what a family would normally use. Nothing extra. We don't even have a dishwasher. We wash our dishes by hand. Can't afford to get the dishwasher fixed. We had one for a couple of years, and it broke down. Do you rush to call a plumber? I don't. I mean, you know, there's everything costs $1,000. You try to get anything done, it's like $1,000. So finally, I had to call a plumber for one thing, and they screwed it up. They screwed it up bad. And it says all work guaranteed, warranty, 1 year, something like that. You know, so this was way within a year. This was, and I call him and say, hey, you know, this thing you put in. I was very friendly because, you know, I want to establish a relationship with some sort of plumber or people that I can trust, and it never works. They're all out to get you. They are all out to screw you over, you know? And they want to pretend, I'm just a contractor. I'm just barely making a living. No, you're making money off other working people. I consider you a mugger. You're doing crime to other people. You better lower your rates, buddy. Or let's just make that public ownership too, because it's getting to the point where people can't afford housing repairs. You know, it's getting really, really crazy. Including for us. So, but I had to hire a plumber for this one repair, right? And then it messes up. And then you call him and say, oh, I don't warranty equipment. That's obviously an equipment thing. Well, first of all, he didn't look at it to see if it was equipment or what was going on. Secondly, of course, it's going to be equipment. What else is it? It's all equipment. The whole, everything is equipment. You know, what are you talking about? And this guy would not, you know, so I kept my cool. I was just like, well, he said, well, you got to go buy new this or that, and I'll put it in, but I charge $120 an hour. And that's low for some of these jokers, right? And $120 an hour just to walk in. He only worked 45 minutes last time. We still paid $120 for the little thing we had him do. Now it's $120 to come in and fix something that I screwed up. He didn't say I screwed up, but that's what happened. And I'm like, so I guess we'll have to go buy some new equipment. And yeah, I'll give you a call back. And of course, I never called him back. Never will. That's that. Thanks a lot for screwing us over. And if I got people on the air here, if I lined up people, how many times you get screwed over on apartment or house repairs? Give us a couple anecdotes, a couple stories about the fun you've had with contractors. And of course, the corporate media touches on these stories every once in a while too. They're the ones that they say, call the hotline. There's a couple stations that used to do this. I don't know if they still do. Call the hotline and we'll chase up the contractors and get you your money back or get you your service completed or whatever. And those are very, very sad and yet at the same time amusing stories, because rarely do you see the contractor have to mumble their way through how they rip somebody off completely. Like what they'll do, like I remember one, they'll say, okay, we'll pave your driveway. So they start paving your driveway and they don't finish it. Something more lucrative came up, so they just dropped your job and went to the other job. And then they said, no, we can't. We didn't finish it. So, we can't. We don't have time to finish it. We can't give you back your deposit or whatever. Stuff like that. You know, just blatant ripoff, blatantly not finishing work. I had years ago another plumber come in to do a job and just decided the job was too much money. Stopped returning. You know, they couldn't even like get together the wherewithal to fix it, you know, the people they needed and so on. Or they suspected we couldn't afford it, which was also true. And they just boogied, they left, you know. And so then we're left with this thing not fixed forever, basically, you know. Important thing too. But anyway. So back to the point though, vacation. Can't afford a vacation? Get another credit card. News about America's dire financial straits turns into a credit card commercial. This is from FAIR, the Fairness in Action Reporting website. What's the date here? Well, I printed it out on August 8th, but it's not from August 8th. I think it's from, they're commenting on a report from earlier in the year. But let's just, it was on their website, so I don't have an exact date for this this article, but I think it's fairly recent, even though they're commenting on an article earlier in the year. And they said, well, you know, for tens of millions of Americans, there will be no summer vacation because they can't afford one. A new and widely reported poll from financial services company Bankrate.com found that over 1 in 4 people are foregoing a vacation primarily because they cannot pay for it. Absolutely correct. I say it's more than 1 in 4. Just my anecdotal evidence. The average expected cost of a vacation for those planning one was $1,979. That's $2,000. But as a well-publicized survey found recently, the large majority of millennials and a majority of Americans overall are living paycheck to paycheck and could not even afford a $1,000 emergency, let alone a $2,000 luxury. So anyway, they say majority of Americans overall. So when I gave that 40% figure living paycheck to paycheck, I was unintentionally not giving the full amount, the full extent to which people are living paycheck to paycheck. So then they quote a story from, and this is what FAIR does. They talk about facts, but then they put them. How did the media comment on the facts? Well, a CNBC report from April 25th, 2019, and this is where the poll was, I guess. They followed up their story on, why don't you just get more credit cards to, you know, go into debt more to afford this vacation? So here it is. Let's how they say it. Expert, quote unquote, financial advice. How better to forecast your money from the bland, watch what you spend, quote unquote, to have a staycation, quote unquote, to the insultingly obvious make more money, quote unquote. And then they add, quote, this is the one that they're going to focus on. Add income streams, end quote. Now, what that meant was, you could get 1,000 to 10,000 extra more per month. How? By getting the right credit card could help. bonuses and so on. And this is dubious advice, according to Fair, and I'm quoting from the article. This is dubious advice, quote, this is dubious advice. Americans already owe more than $1 trillion in credit card debt, and the average new credit card interest rate is over 19%. To be fair, CNBC's article does come up with a disclaimer that you should not spend beyond your means. Picking up the right credit card is the key to affording a trip. So we've talked on the show before about credit card debt. Now, there's something about credit card debt, though, that people don't always understand. Variable interest rates, right? So you have these interest rates. You start off with what seems like a relatively low one for a credit card, and all of a sudden you're paying like 18% or something, 19%, and then now they have interest rates in 20%. And once you put a chunk on there that you can't pay off, that just astronomically exponentially increases the amount of money you owe this company out of nowhere, money that you did not borrow that is just having interest rate charges tacked onto it, that you're going to have to pay off if you want to not have your credit destroyed, and then you're using credit reports for all sorts of things now, job applications and background checks and all this. So this credit thing is like a really tightening noose on the neck of American working class people, and it's really, really horrible. And it could easily pass a law tomorrow like they had in the past. You cannot have credit card rates over X percent, you know? We shouldn't even need credit. We should make enough money as long as we have to suffer under capitalism to be able to afford what we need. And interest rates of any type, interest payments of any type should be outlawed. You know, there's no reason for that. That's just money that you're getting from borrowing money, but the money's already there, and they're only letting out a small percentage of what they have in terms of borrowing, in terms of a pool to borrow from. Then they go into some other corporate media outlets. Fox News picked up the same thing from bankreport.com, the poll, and they were even more enthusiastic about using credit cards. lucrative ongoing rewards, quote unquote. The story, quote, thus a story that began by detailing the financial woes of the poor seemed to turn into an extended credit card commercial. That was on Fox News 429/19, Forbes 425/19, even provided hyperlinks to the credit card web pages to sign up for them without any disclaimer at all about overspending. And this continued to other news outlets they mentioned. And then it says, quote, this is a common phenomenon in modern media. Competition from online advertising has led to a financial crisis for the press. Total U.S. newspaper advertising revenue dropped from $49.3 billion in 2006 to an estimated $14.3 billion in 2018, with little to no growth in circulation revenue. As a consequence, newsroom employees have halved over the same time period, but journalists are expected to produce more content than ever and with fewer resources. Into this vacuum has stepped the public relations industry, to the point where there are now 6 public relations agents or PR agents for every journalist. Under greater time pressure than ever, media resort to rewriting or copying and pasting press releases, then branding them as news. At the same time, advertorials, paid advertisements presented as news, are becoming an increasingly common way for media to increase their income. Advertorials work. The general public has great difficulty distinguishing between paid content for... between paid for content and traditional news. A Reader's Digest study found news consumers were 500 times more likely to read an advertorial than a traditional advertisement, and that advertorials generated 81% more sales than standard commercials. Were the bank rate stories advertorials or simply media lazily repeating public relations? CNBC responded with a comment that suggested it was an organic story, while Fox did not reply. Either way, Americans are in perilous financial straits, and millions are trapped in debt. Media should not be handing out highly questionable recommendations for the sake of extra content. There could be expensive consequences for those who take advice from cheap news. And I just wanted to get into that article because it resonated with me, with my family. And also, there's an implicit thing that if anyone tells you to go into debt to afford something, the implication is you're not already in debt. Where does that come from? Most of us are already in debt. You know, the for example, the cost for college education has risen 500% in a very short amount of time. And show me a family with a kid going to college that's not in debt for that. I mean, even if you get scholarships and so on, it doesn't cover everything. And you're going into debt for that. Or if you have to rely on cars for transportation, you're in debt. Also, the whole thing about home ownership, as much as that's like considered a big deal, you know, the American dream is sometimes defined as having your own home. Sometimes it's defined as ruthlessly, you know, becoming the top dog in a top rat in the rat race. But whatever, however you define it, or both, number of people owning homes is dropping. But on top of that, as you well know, if you follow this at all, the price of homes in most areas is just ridiculous. And buying a house is just ridiculous, the price. But what is a mortgage? A mortgage is a huge debt that you've incurred to say you own a house and really the bank owns it, which is really, really horrible, actually. And they put tons of interest on that debt. So I speak from my own experience. You spend all your time paying off the interest before you even get down to the actual amount of money you borrowed. And it's just... it's just demoralizing, it's depressing and wrong. And of course, you're paying that every month, your mortgage being the big chunk of payment that you can't get around. You got to pay that because you got to keep a roof over your head. Same thing with the rent. And I lived through that most of my life, renting. That's where the money's got to go. So you'll sacrifice anything else for that. No vacations ever. no health care. If you can't afford that, that's got to go to the rent. And less food. You know, they talk about food insecurity in America, and some people are like, how could that be? You know, I go in the grocery store and a lot of stuff on the shelves, usually. Sometimes things screw up, and that's not the case, like with the Stop and Shop strike or a natural disaster or something. But anyway, so usually there's like food on the shelves and stuff. We won't get into how much of it's food and how much of it is like garbage. But the point is like, well, if you can't afford that, and the food prices are supposedly low now, but I consider them very, very high. Like everything seems to cost like $3 now. So every item you get is going to be about $2.99. That stuff can add up fast, really, really fast. And I've had this situation where I've gone to the grocery store, the best of intentions, healthy food for my kids, you know, nothing superfluous, no desserts, nothing, you know, and I somehow walk out. Well, realizing, gee, I forgot protein. There's not much protein in this stuff in this bag here, you know? and I'm still paying. I just, you know, got hit $60, $80 or something, and I got very little protein to show for it there, you know? And that is, I'm shopping bottom of the barrel places, you know, cheapest places I can. So the point is like, you're paying money out, and if someone says, well, just, you know, take out a little debt for this or that. You're already in debt. You're going to take on more, you know, and then you're going to spend the rest of your life paying off credit card debt, which a lot of people are doing. Not to mention people paying student loan debt their whole life. It's getting to the point now in terms of the population, right? Because you had an upsurge in people going to college in the United States in the 1960s and 70s. And starting even in the 50s, gradual, but then accelerating number of people going to college. So you have about 55% of the population attending college, only about 25% or less graduating, by the way, but about 55% trying some college here or there, right? So what happens is like with the increase in the price of tuition, room and board if you go that way, apartments if you go that way, whatever, apartments and food if you go that way, it gets to be such a huge expense that, and you're going to be, and there's pictures appearing in Facebook and other places where really obviously older people, elderly people are paying student debt years and years later because those interest rates we were just talking about. Why does interest exist? Why does interest exist? Interest should not exist, you know? And yet, there it is, paying in your old age for a couple years of college. And don't get me wrong, college takes a hit because it is, and it should, because it's run by corporations, so it's obviously going to be flawed from the start. You know, forget the nonprofit term, it doesn't mean anything. College is run by corporations with corporate values, and even the state-run schools, meaning in the United States, literally the states, there's no federal colleges I'm aware of, maybe there are, but run by the states, They still run on a business model and try to replicate making profits and do all that stuff to screw you over that a business would do. But maybe with a little more regulation, or and they tend to be a little cheaper sometimes and all that. But they're getting expensive. They're raising tuition like crazy. These public schools. So basically, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of debt carryover from that. And if you dare to have children and the child care and all the expenses of having children. Now, right now around here, it's like back to school. So now, yeah, you go in and you buy all this stuff that should be provided to the child. But in America, you're buying it all on your own, whether it's textbooks in some places, some schools even, or even public schools sometimes. And then also, but all, you know, pens and notebooks and stuff like that. This is ridiculous. Another thing that we do every year on this show in Social Alternative Radio around this time is we usually talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the two times, the only two times in history that atomic bombs were dropped on civilians or on anyone. The rest were tests on supposedly vacant land in different places. But in the end of World War II, as our listeners probably know, the United States government dropped atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And to this day in the United States, there's this huge propaganda mill that comes out when if this gets reported on in the corporate media that says, you know, oh, it was necessary, it had to happen. And of course, people have debunked those fake news theories, if you want to use the Trumpian phrase, the fake news theories around Hiroshima and Nagasaki being necessary at all necessary. It's just a complete, they've been completely disproved and discredited. And yet they still exist in a lot of people's heads. Oh, Japanese wouldn't have surrendered. It would have been like, well, they were already trying to surrender. Oh, but the Japanese were so tough. Well, you dropped the bombs on civilians. Were the children tough? Were the women there that weren't a part of the Japanese war machine? Were they tough, you know? Might have had something to do with the Soviet Union being willing to invade Japan. And then the United States, was already running into in Eastern Europe, not being able to control the situation totally like they wanted to, et cetera. Anyway, so Hiroshima, the new arms race, no winners. This is someone named Robert Dodge posted August 8th in counterpunch.org, where he connects Hiroshima and Nagasaki to what's the latest threats in nuclear weapon proliferation. So I'm just going to, I don't have time for part of this, but 74 years ago, the United States dropped the first atomic bomb over the city of Hiroshima, Japan. There was also Nagasaki after that, 3 days later. Nagasaki, 140,000 were killed at least in Hiroshima and 80,000 more at least in Nagasaki. And he says, and I agree with this, these events, and it's hard for Americans to stomach, but listen to this. These events changed history and made the U.S. the most feared and ultimately most dangerous country in the world. Now, the perception, if you're an American, an average American, is the exact opposite. We're the good guys. Everyone around the world just wants to cheer us in. Vietnam cut across that, of course, but they've erased the memory of Vietnam to a great extent. And or tried to. I'm not saying everyone believes this stuff. But, you know, the fact that the United States has military bases all over the world, we're still the nice guys, you know? Anyway, don't have time to develop that theme too much more right now. Let's just go into the details here of the nuclear arms race. So following World War II and the Cold War between the United States and the former Soviet Union, there was this immediate, this bloated nuclear stockpiles that continue to today of 13,850 nuclear weapons. The vast majority, 91% of these weapons, are controlled by the U.S. and Russia now, with the rest in seven other nuclear states. So that's almost 14,000 nuclear weapons. That is sick. That is so scary, because a fraction of those, a tiny fraction of those, can destroy the planet. Most of today's weapons are many times more powerful than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki atomic bombs. For decades, arms control treaties, you know, tried to keep this in check, supposedly. At the height of the Cold War, there were excess of 60,000 nuclear weapons. So some have been gotten rid of. There was the 1970 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, where the non-nuclear nations, which is almost all the nations on the planet, agreed to not develop nuclear weapons. If, by the way, a lot of people don't know this about 1970 nuclear non-proliferation, if the other countries that had nuclear weapons got rid of theirs, right? But that part never happened. 1987 Intermediate Nuclear Task Force Treaty, This was more reductions and eliminating certain categories. And now, though, this 1987 treaty, all of a sudden, August 2nd of this year, the U.S., you know, under Trump and so on, withdraws from this treaty. So this was just the latest by the Trump administration following on the withdrawal of the U.S. last year from the multinational Iran nuclear deal. So, in 2011, though, just so you don't think it's just Trump, again, as you often hear about Trump, he's the symptom, not the disease. The new arms race began in 2011 when President Obama made his, quote, grand bargain when he agreed to modernize the U.S. weapons arsenal in trade for needed Republican support, to ratify the treaty. This renewed arms race has been estimated to cost $1.7 trillion over the next 30 years with inflation. And this creates a situation where the U.S. is way ahead of all the other countries. And so the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which you may have heard of, they follow the risks of nuclear war. And that's out of the consciousness of a lot of people, because a lot of the corporate media has been talking about this at all. But they say that with nuclear weapons and climate change as the, quote, new abnormal, end quote, the doomsday clock, which is this thing where they say how far are we away from a possible nuclear war, is now set at 2 minutes to midnight, where midnight represents nuclear apocalypse. And this is the closest at any point that's been set. In June, the United States published online, later took down Nuclear Operations Document 3-72, where it outlined plans for fighting and, quote, winning, unquote, a nuclear war. Incredibly, the document states, using nuclear weapons could create conditions for decisive results and the restoration of strategic stability. Specifically, the use of a nuclear weapon will fundamentally change the scope and of a battle and create conditions that affect how commanders will prevail in conflict. Now, so these statements fly in the face of scientific fact and reality. Nothing but death will prevail in a nuclear war. Nuclear war and climate change are two existential threats we face today. And by the way, I don't know if the article goes into this because I haven't reread it lately, but these two things are actually connected, that a nuclear detonation of any sort would wreak havoc with the climate, and they already have, actually. But I guess this doesn't go into that too much. But Physicians for Social Responsibility, in a publication called Nuclear Famine, 2 Billion People at Risk, have documented that even a limited regional nuclear war using less than half of 1% of the global nuclear arsenals will result in potential deaths of 2 billion people on the planet. There is no adequate medical or humanitarian response to nuclear war. Prevention is the only answer, and that can only be achieved with the abolition of nuclear weapons. Civil society and non-nuclear states have responded with the leadership of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN. The international community has spoken. 2017 United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, that's 2017, was their response. It's got signatories of 70 nations. But all this is, you know, the article doesn't say this, but all this is perfunctory, symbolic stuff. You know, you need regime change, basically. You need economic system change to get to the point where nuclear weapons aren't at each other's throats, because even with nuclear weapon at each country's throats, even with nuclear weapons, there's a material basis for the use of nuclear weapons, and it still is the basis of competition over markets and cheap labor and natural resources and all the things that go into capitalism, successful quote unquote capitalist exploitation and wealth. And you know, there's no accident, for example, this is one way you could connect this. There's a million ways. The United States should consider the safe haven in terms of investments. It's the investment place of last resort or something because of its huge nuclear arsenal. Who's going to invade the United States, destabilize, take over, you know, assets and so on? Like the United States, by the way, just took over the assets, just stole the assets of Venezuela, you know, completely illegally and so on, just stole them. But who's going to do that to the United States? Venezuela's not going to do that to the United States. They don't have nuclear weapons, you know. And even if they did, with the United States' nuclear arsenal, again, you get into the whole mutually assured destruction thing. So the U.S. is sitting on top as the sole world power, the most powerful world power, afraid to attack certain countries with nuclear weapons, but not afraid to go to the brink, as they say. And that's happening with different scenarios, has happened and will happen again. And who knows what would trigger a nuclear war? I mean, I don't want to speculate because there's a lot of scenarios that could lead to that. And the author of this, you know, says there's a national movement called Back from the Brink that supports the treaties that was mentioned and precautionary steps. And, you know, I wouldn't denigrate at all any attempts to organize against nuclear proliferation of nuclear weapons. And by the way, I would add nuclear energy, which this author doesn't do, because that can be easily turned into nuclear weapons, the byproducts. But let's face it. I mean, there's been these liberal, well-meaning groups around ever since the atomic bombs were unleashed, and they do nothing. They do very little. They do very little, and it's not enough. The problem continues. The problem is linked to the economic system. It's not just a problem of a rogue technology, because you have to bring so many resources together to actually build a nuclear weapon that it could be something that could be outlawed, could be something that could be completely kept off the of humanity's plate, so to speak. That's a wrong metaphor, but it could be something that humans just are not allowed to do by other humans. And on a world scale, not individuals, I'm talking about individuals, on a world scale, just no, that's not, those, you know, uranium mining or whatever, that stuff is not going to happen. Bringing together the resource for that, you're not going to have nuclear power, so you're not going to be able to use that. You know, you could actually cut off nuclear weapons production and proliferation on a material basis at its root. And then you wouldn't just have the edifice of laws, because under capitalism, laws are broken every day by the capitalists. You would just have that edifice, but in a decent society, in a socialist society, a democratic society, you would have, yeah, sure, you'd have rules and laws and stuff, but you would also have just the material basis for it. What group of rich people, what wealthy, super wealthy nation is going to get together, is going to use its wealth for that? They're not going to even exist. We're going to have internationalism if we survive, and we're going to have people cooperating with each other, working with each other, and not have even the resources to get together on a certain level, a tiny minority of people to do that. You could make an argument that as long as the technology exists somewhere, it could reemerge somehow. I wouldn't deny that. There's a lot of scenarios that could happen. It would, in a social society, be like, well, hugely impossibly dangerous. You've got the history of it. And then on top of that, you have a horrible waste of resources. And what is our self-interest in destroying our planet and our fellow human beings? We don't have it. We're all about making things better. That's what a real social society would work for. Speaking of Counterpunch, where I read that last article, but a different topic. They had an article called Blue No Matter Who, Lesser Evil. Oh, I'm sorry, question mark at the end of that. Blue No Matter Who, Lesser Evilism in the Age of Trump by Alan Nasser. And I've read some of his stuff before. It's interesting stuff. NASSER. It's published August 6, 2019. And he goes into this interesting, sort of logical look at the two-party system and lesser evilism, how it really doesn't work. He goes, the logic of lesser evil thinking. It's really funny stuff, interesting stuff. It's not comic at all. I mean, he's seriously, how this doesn't follow any sort of logical thinking. But I'll just give you a little taste of it. Please read it on your own. And again, the article is called, he wrote a book called Overripe Economy, American Capitalism and the Crisis of Democracy. I didn't read that yet. Looks good, though. But he's got this article, like I said, Blue No Matter Who, Lesser Evilism in the Age of Trump, Counterpunch, August 6th, 2019, Nasser, NASSER. So here we go. He's like, okay, we've heard it said countless times that while President Obama was a colossal letdown to his initial boosters, voting for him was imperative, quote, given the alternative, end quote. He may be a, quote, disappointment, end quote, but the other guy will be much worse. This is surely the reasoning behind the lesser evil apologist. Let's spell out the logic at work here. He refers to earlier that I didn't read. The thought pattern is clear enough to represent in the form of a deductive chain of reasoning from premises to conclusion. One, the world of politics is coextensive and the range of possibilities permitted by the Democratic-Republican Party system. He puts a dash between Democrat-Republican, Democrat-Republican Party system. To think otherwise is unrealistic, utopian, naive, and worst of all, unpragmatic. He's not saying this is what he believes. He's saying this is the thinking behind, from the corporations on down to many people that are brainwashed by that kind of thinking. The idea is to win, and right now the only possible winner is a Democrat or Republican. To vote otherwise is to, quote, throw away your vote, end quote. Two, therefore, when voting, the choice is always and only between a Republican or a Democrat. And then he puts Tina in caps. That's what Margaret Thatcher's famous phrase of, When challenged about the ravages of capitalism, she would just say TINA. She created an acronym, if that's the right word. She created a abbreviation of there is no alternative down to TINA, and she would use that as shorthand, meaning that to think of socialism or communism or anything else is beyond the pale. You couldn't even think of it anymore. And unfortunately, a certain number of right-wing labor leaders bought into that. But now, as you can see in England and other places, at least on a superficial basis, but I'd say a deeper basis too, socialism is getting more popular. Three, to follow this, what does he call it? A deductive chain of reasoning. Three, there are no, and this is the from lesser evilism standpoint, there are no finite limits to the possibilities of greater badness. However a bad policy might be, it could always be worse. This is very interesting. I've argued this with people that argue this. They say, well, if you vote for so-and-so, it could always be worse. This is a part of a lesser evil argument. So vote for Democrat because Republican could always be worse. And I feel like saying, well, isn't it bad enough? When is it bad enough for you? How many people have to die? How many homeless people? How many people die from bad medical care? How many people, die in these stupid wars the capitalists use for oil and so on, do for oil and so on? When is it bad enough, even though it could always be worse? Well, I don't know. Maybe there's a point where it can't always be worse because, a nuclear war has been triggered, or a climate change has gotten to the point where it's irreversible, at least in the short term or whatever. So anyway, he says, Nasser says, worst possible policy, quote unquote, is like the greatest possible number, quote unquote. There's really no such thing. So think about that for a minute, because it goes into the infinite, I guess. Although I would say there is a finite on worst possible. It could always be worse in terms of certain aspects of politics and economics. Four, however bad the Democratic candidate may be, the Republican will be worse. So this is and again, he's playing devil's advocate here, well-confirmed empirical generalization. There's not really any logic there. Five, the lesser evil is always a better choice than the greater evil. Self-evident tautology. So he's using the laws of logic to shoot down these supposedly logic arguments. Tautology is not does not follow a rational argument. A rational argument is not contained a tautology. In other words, tautology. Six, therefore, when voting, the best choice is always the Democrat, follows from points 2 through 5. Note that when the only choice is between a greater and a lesser evil, the lesser evil is not only the better choice, it is the best choice. How about that? When the choice is between a greater and lesser evil. So that's what he was saying. That's kind of what I was trying to get at. You got two evils, but the lesser evil is the better choice always. Okay. However bad the Democrat is, number seven, there are no limits to how bad he can be. So it's always best to vote for him? That doesn't really... he's playing devil's advocate, but you can easily put a question mark on that. Doesn't matter how bad the Democrat is, I'll vote for him. Follows trivially from number seven. This capitulation has taken two forms in the Trump era. The first was anyone but Trump, in order to drive home the dogma that any alternative to Trump must be a Democrat. The slogan became blue no matter who. And nine, accordingly, I need know nothing more than a candidate is a Democrat to justify voting for him. Being sufficiently informed about a candidate's politics comes to knowing whether he's a Democrat. That follows from 7 and 8. This little exercise in Logic 101 does not suggest that the voter is Mr. Spock, always and only moved by unadulterated reason. Outside of philosophy class, no such creature is recognizably human. Still, while reasoning in accord with logical canons, meaning logical rules, it is not sufficient to render one's thinking impeccable. It is necessary. And so our lesser evil liberal is unassailable on this ground. His conclusion does indeed follow from his premises. Let's ignore for the moment the problematic premises. Yeah, that's very good. What is relevant to this self-deception is that the liberal pays a heavy price for constructing a valid inference from his premises to his desired conclusion, 6 above, that it's always best to vote for a Democrat. For the same line of reasoning that got him to 6 also sticks in with 7, 8, and 9, claims he surely will disavow. Meaning, for example, however bad the Democrat is, and there are no limits to how bad he can act, it's always best to vote for him, stuff like that. Okay, so there are probably a few Democratic voters who there would, as the philosopher would say, swallow the reductio. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. R-E-D-U-C-T-I-O. It's a Latin. Since these specimens will have, you've heard of reductio ad absurdism, absurd something like that, reduced to absurdity. Since these specimens always have voluntarily embraced absurdity, we will allow them to hold their peace. But no one will unabashedly aver that he would vote Democrat, whatever the politics the latter might endorse. Nor would any liberal admit that the mere fact that a candidate is a Democrat is sufficient to win his vote. Perhaps especially in politics, we feel obliged to give reasons for our choices, and just because he's a Democrat doesn't make it a plausible reason. So basically what he's setting up is, so you have this logical problems here. We'll just kind of ignore those and then look at, well, wait a minute, how do you work your way out of that and the rest of it? So he quotes this guy, Todd Gitlin, and his book, Letters to a Young Activist. Quote, in the presidential contest between Hubert Humphrey and Richard Nixon, Humphrey would have phased out the war as opposed to Nixon, who proceeded to extend the Vietnam War for 5 years. Gitlin takes this lesson to be clear. You either vote Democratic or submit to the rule of the Republicans. The Democratic Party is an inescapable field where you either win, lose, or draw. Nowadays, the unapologetic slogan blue, no matter who, is anyone but, i.e. anyone but Trump. Now, the problem with, and this guy, I'm talking about this myself, he doesn't go into it, Nassar, but the problem with that 68 analogy is that it was clear the Democrats had not only supported, but brought the Vietnam War into much more, brought soldiers, Americans, and also Australians and others, much more deeper into the Vietnam War. Johnson, who had originally run against the war, became, that was the time period during his regime that became the hugest increase. Kennedy was increasing before he was assassinated, U.S. involvement in Vietnam. You cannot follow that the Republicans would have been worse. They both, at that time, were interested in pursuing the war. Even through 1972, as we've talked about on the show before, in the context of left populism of the Democrats not being a new thing, McGovern, liberal Democrat from Massachusetts, I believe, runs as ending the war in 1972. That's a very popular, based on the mass movements against the war. And yet prominent Democrats then turn and say, no, we can't vote for McGovern. That's too rash. We can't just end the war, blah, blah, blah. A lot of them were still for the war, even as late as 72. They publicly disavowed voting for McGovern. Some of them even voted for Nixon, said they would vote for Nixon, and so on. A paradigm case for political self-suspension, Obama as a New Deal liberal, and he goes into some good history about the Obama administration that's very good, and talks about how there was a plan to get rid of Social Security. Let's just look at this for a second. Okay, in the FDR-LBJ tradition, Social Security was referred to as the third rail of American politics. It was inconceivable that any Democrat would consider touching it. I thought he was going to get into, like, somebody did touch it, and that was Clinton, I believe, was working with Newt Gingrich to a plan that almost got put into power, place to get rid of Social Security, but in a quick, here it is, he does get into it. So, anyway, Clinton and Newt Gingrich put together a bill that would initiate the gradual privatization of Social Security. Obama was appointed as co-chairs of his deficit reduction committee, Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, two of Washington's most ardent opponents of Social Security. The following remark, he just bounces in and out of Social Security that it seems like, the Democrats would never attack that, and they were actually have attacked it, some of them, and they were making plans to just eliminate it. That seems to be, don't think that's off the cards. I think as it gets close to the election, it probably is most likely, but that is not something that is going to disappear. You'll see the propaganda against Social Security, much of it completely false, and that will not go away. So anyway, I just want to really point out that article more than get into it too much. And you are listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And I think that I will take a little musical break here because we haven't had one yet. And check it out. I think we got some Roy Cooter up first.
Standing on the corner, spending my time, not of a job, not earning a dime. Lady steps up, glasses, I suppose. You're a stylish young man by the looks of your clothes. She said, trust me and take a little tip. This building's been sold to Johnny Depp. Who? Take the bow, relocate. The Google men are coming downtown, so don't be late. See, this is my apartment. Just a hole in the wall. Got to sleep in the kitchen with your feet in the hall. No hot water, no windows and doors. You gotta make it past all the real estate agents, junkies and hoes. Heart of the city, ain't no coffee shops around. I heard them Google men drink so much coffee, I declare, I think they might drown. Gentrification is here. Oh, one thing I know, you can't stand pat. I declare you got to step it up and go.
Last
started in resentment. A year's long wait on my brain.
Red, Black, Red with American Fever. I'm sorry, with Resettlement. Before that, same band, American Fever Dream. Before that, Ride Cooler with Gentrification. I decided to throw on an extra song there because I was into Red, Black, Red. We didn't get to some other stuff. We are out of time. Thanks for listening to Social Alternative Radio. We'll be back in 2 weeks, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m.